This podcast was recorded at Hartford Street Zen Center, Isanji, in San Francisco. Please help support our temple by making a donation at hszc.org.
I never know how a place is going to strike me. And today I'm a little surprised to be struck so hard by this place. There's so many people that I have lived with and cared about and chatted with whose pictures are in this house and who are no longer alive. Pretty soon, me too. I've known for a long time that sad and sweet go together. Sorrow and joy go together. I'm feeling that back and forth. So what I brought today to talk about is a koan that I have known, heard for a long time and thought about off and on. You may have heard it already. It's popular. back to my Dharma brother, dear Mio, who I can't see at the moment. He's blocked by... Ah, there he is. Ben is fully here in front. in his room, he has a little drawing by Michael Wenger of this koan. Which moon is this? So a monk named Fayan was sweeping the ground. Yunyan was sweeping the ground, and his brother monk, Dawu, came up to him and said, "Too busy." And Yunyan said, "Well, you should know there's one who is not busy." And Dawu said, "Then there are two moons." And Yunyan held up his broom and said, "Which moon is this?" So when I was getting ready to come here today, I noticed two very familiar emotional experiences that I was having. One was the bit of anxiety, the, "Oh, it's time to give a talk" anxiety. What'll I say? How's it going to go? It's a very old, familiar, just to show up somewhere, to be with other people. There's a little bit of anxiety there. And then the other side is, with the anxiety comes an appreciation for this opportunity to think about my life and to think about what I care about and what it has to do with the teaching of the Buddha, if anything. A lot of times I don't think about that at all. I go through the day, I'm shopping, I'm driving in the car, I'm talking to people, I go this way, I go that way, I go straight ahead, and I'm not wondering what this has to do with the teaching of the Buddha. So today, right here in this room, I'm wondering about that. And there's anxiety about that question. So this koan, sweeping the ground, got me to think about, again, how I got into this Zen business in the first place. And I used to be a nice girl. I had a life, and I long hair, ideas, plans. And then you know, something happened, something rather significant happened. And so for me, that when I think about, well, what was it that happened, you know, there's a particular thing, a particular moment that comes to mind for me. And it certainly was not the early morning wake-up bell. And it wasn't the long, intense sitting periods. And it wasn't the great, grand ideas of the Buddha Dharma. It was none of those. For me, it was a small vase of flowers, wildflowers, sitting on a bedside table down at Tassajara in a room I'd been sent to clean. And I stood there looking at this vase of flowers and being transformed on the spot to someone very grateful, very sweet, very calm, out of time, just for a little while. It didn't last very long. Yeah, pretty soon I was back making beds and setting up the rooms and so on. But that moment had had a huge impact on the course of my life. So I thought, you know, I mean, I'm actually fairly sure that all of you have a story like that. Maybe you don't even remember what that story is, or maybe you do, or maybe there have been many of them, but I think we all carry these moments, these memories. The Buddha's memory was of a time under an apple tree when he was 14, when he was at peace. And I think children often have those moments. And then we go back, we reassemble our normal life. Yeah, the person that we're all of us are sitting here right now. Maybe not so special. I don't know how you think of yourselves, but I'm not so special. We have a friend whose name is Brother David Stendelrost, who's been coming to Zen Center for as long as I can remember, since he was a young monk and we were young ourselves, and now he's an old man. And he called these moments spiritual emergencies, as in emerging some big question, some big urge coming forward. And, you know, these emergencies are, sometimes they're pleasant. Sometimes it's a kiss or a postcard, flowers. But sometimes it's really scary, like a car full of clowns. So, you know, for me, these koans engage me in a kind of remembering of my own path. What's my path? I mean, we all share DNA. You know, we're so close, we're practically the same. You know, and along with flatworms and everybody else, you know, we're very close, living beings. But at the same time, our stories are so different. If we each went along and told our stories, well, first of all, we'd be here forever, but then it would be so different, so amazing how we all came to be here right now. My daughter had a little thing she was doing when she was about 8. She would go, we live at Green Gulch, and she would go from table to table, and I started to follow her around because she was asking this question, the answers to which were absolutely fascinating. She was saying to people, did you ever come close to dying? Did anything ever happen to you that was really scary? And boy, they sure did. Everybody. You know, it was a skateboard or a bicycle or a car or a cliff or something. You know, like, wow, we have no idea what we're carrying. You know, I can't see who you are from here, but I'd love to know your story. So I think these moments are a little bit like we imagine that this normal world where we get along together, more or less. There's a veil there, we imagine, that is lifted now and then, and we can see this luminous vision of a brighter world, you know, another world, another moon, better moon, another planet to go with the moon, peaceful and kind and always green. So this is what I'm exploring in this talk, is like these two moons, the one I dream of and the one I bear with. There was a film I saw years ago, and I can never remember if it was called Afterlife or Everlasting or Ever After, but it's a Japanese film, and maybe one of you have seen it and do know the title. It's about people being asked a question, somewhat like my daughter's question. These folks were doing a documentary, and they asked people on the street in Japan, if you could choose one memory from your life to have as your eternal moment, what would it be? And the answers they got from people were so remarkable that they realized they had a great film on their hands, so they made a film. And there are many characters in this film, some of them the actual people, some were actors, but the opening scene, you're in this old high school, and there's a desk, and the people are just coming in and there's from the clouds, walking into, and they're being told that they've died, and that this is a kind of halfway house where they're going to transition to eternity, and they are given a caseworker to help them to figure out what they want to remember. And so the film goes on, and you get to know the people, and one of them is a man who had just learned to fly. And he remembered a moment entering a pink cloud at sunset in this little plane. So then you see the caseworkers recreate that memory. They have a real plane, little plane, and cotton clouds, pink cotton clouds hung on wires. And they film the memory. And then they play it back in an audience about the size of this in a small theater. And as they're showing the memory, that man vanishes. So then there's a woman who had gotten ballerina slippers when she was little. There's another man who remembered the spring breeze of spring hitting his face when he was little through a crack in the glass of a trolley as he was riding through bombed out Japanese city. Breeze. That was his memory. And then the last one of the film is the caseworker. One of these young caseworkers, very handsome young man, and you begin to learn his story, which is that he was killed in battle and he never saw his wife and his unborn child. And he had no memory he wanted to remember forever. He had nothing happy. Everything was blocked by his untimely death. And finally, in the last scene of the film, he's sitting on the bench in the garden, and he's smiling, and he's filled with love. And they're filming him, and you wonder, what's he looking at? What has he chosen? You know? And then they let you see that what he's looking at is all of his fellow caseworkers who he has grown to love in his time in the in-between world. So, spiritual emergency. So I suppose I would choose that vase of flowers, you know, if I had to. Okay, that'd be all right. That was a pretty good moment. You know, and then because I have a hard time landing on any particular place for very long, I thought, well, what about all those other moments that I didn't choose? What was wrong with them? What was wrong with the rest of my life? You know, what am I overlooking? So that's really what I'm wanting to talk about this morning, is, you know, How do we know what is and isn't so? How do we know what's right for us and not right for us? And, you know, which moon is it? Which moon is it? So this story of the two moons is from the Book of Serenity, which you may know. It's case 21 called Yunyan Sweeps the Ground. Some of you may practice here for a while, or perhaps you've lived at one of the Zen centers, and some of you I know have lived at the Zen centers. So we do a lot of sweeping. It's one of the big jobs that you get. After meditation, you're asked to do a few things, housekeeping chores. But, you know, this is familiar to all of us who have households or rooms or whatever. We sweep. As I drove up, there was a man sweeping out front of his house. So sweep the ground. And I think it's kind of funny that in this rapid-fire world where we have cell phones and instant messaging and jet planes and driving machines, that someone sweeping the ground would be accused of being too busy. Doesn't seem fair. But, you know, when I think about myself too busy, it's not about what I'm doing. It's about the energy and the tension in my hands and in my heart, in my brain, my thoughts, my breath. Too busy. There's anxiety there. There's tension there. I'm being pushed by something, some invisible hand. You know, get this done. Get on to the next thing. Too busy. Not busy enough. I've got so much to do. You know, so that, to me, that's the level of too busy. Like the one I can own. The one I know best. Oh, yeah. I can be too busy doing just about anything. I'm a little busy right now when I check in. Okay. So I wanted to share, partly what I'm wanting to share today is this practice I accept for myself of checking out one side and then checking out the other. You know, if I like something or I think it sounds good or I feel like I'm engaging, well then I want to, you know, see what am I leaving out? What have I overlooked or what am I preferring here and rejecting here? So part of the practice for me is this, what I think of as writing my view of things, or writing my intention, or writing my speech or my actions. Now, how do you get them right? Well, I think it's about writing. You know, it's a verb. You keep looking. You know, is that right? I don't know. How about that? I don't know. So back and forth. Back and forth. So on the one side, there's the too busy. You know, looking at that, trying to see, am I too busy? How would I know if I'm too busy? If I look closely at that story I just said, that I'm a little too busy, well, where's the gauge? Where's the marker, or the dashboard light? Too busy. Well, I don't know. That's not quite right. So, because right there in too busy, I can also see this other side, this temptation almost. Kind of like this, I had an image of an overripe peach. That right there in the anxiety or the tension is this willingness to just drop the whole thing. Just forget about it. Yeah. Just go back and be a hippie. Just move to Hawaii, you know? Smoke dope, quit your job, and just like, you know, whatever. So, you know, there's tension, and then there's release, and then there's release, and then, you know, that's too far, so then you gotta get back to some tension. Back and forth, back and forth. So, you know, when I was first beginning Zen practice, our community kind of blew up, which, I don't know if you all are aware of our history, but it's kind of fascinating in some way. Still going on, still making some more. But, you know, I had been sincere. A sincere Zen student, and I meant it. I was serious, And, you know, when things blew up, it was like, well, you know, to hell with it. This is stupid. I don't trust these people. I don't trust this thing. I don't trust the Zen. I know what, you know, what is this all about? So there was this slipping over to this other side. And I got this t-shirt that said, escape from responsibility. I used to wear it with great pride, you know. This little person running down the road. Escape from responsibility. So, you know, back and forth, back and forth. Which is the way? What is the way? You know, and the Buddha knew us quite well because he knew himself quite well. And he understood that this is the mind, the human mind. We go back and forth. We go too far, and then we go too far. So his very first sermon, the very first sentence of his very first sermon was this. Bhikshus. That's monks. Oh, monks. Bhikshus. Bhikshunis. Male, female monks. There are two extremes. There are two extremes that ought not to be cultivated by one who has gone forth into practice. You know, two extremes. What are those two extremes? What two? There is devotion to the pursuit of pleasure in sensual desire. Hawaii. That's one extreme. And the other extreme is devotion to self-mortification. Mortify, to kill. Kill yourself off. We've had tragically had some people killing themselves. I got a call just on my way over here. Another person that I don't know, but who's dear to a friend of mine, has killed himself. So it's like self-mortification. You know, we can do that and without actually dying. We can kill ourselves off. Our living bodies, our life, engagements. Just too hard. So these are the two extremes which should not be cultivated by one who has gone forth. The middle way, discovered by an awakened one, avoids both of these extremes. It gives vision, gives knowledge, and leads to peace, to direct knowledge, to enlightenment, to nirvana. The middle way. So, you know, these are all clues for us, you know, that's been left for us in the forest, like breadcrumbs, so we can follow. You know, that initial impulse we each had to consider practice, to consider the Dharma, to listen to the teaching, you know, for each of us, some moment of our life that led us into the woods. And then there are these different clues that have been left there for us for centuries, millennia. Same creatures. Same two-legged mammals walking in the woods, confused, struggling, suffering, distracted. So I ask myself again, you know, what does the Dharma have to do with my own life? I mean, what is the teaching of the Buddha? How does that apply? Which moon is this? You know, where does that show up in my effort to practice the Buddha way? So a few of you know me and my life, but I think most of you don't know me because I don't know you. So I will just tell you a little bit about myself currently. I live in a house at Green Gulch. I have a partner, Dr. Grace Dannon, and I have a daughter, Sabrina, who's 18. It's hard to believe. I'm sure you can't believe that. She's 18. And we have a dog, Mac, and three cats. They're kind of irrelevant. I mean, they just sort of do their thing and go outside. But the rest of us are pretty engaged with each other. And 3 years ago in May, my dog and my daughter and my partner were in a head-on collision on the Golden Gate Bridge. And for me, that was a spiritual emergency of the first order. But this one was like the car full of clowns. Yeah. I stood there holding the phone while people are telling me things that I couldn't believe. This isn't possible. And then I kept looking for the second moon. well, they're fine, aren't they? Nobody's hurt, right? You know, no, not right. Not fine. Very bad. And this one moon just kept shining, you know, like I couldn't get out of it. And my partner was very badly injured. She very nearly died. I mean, that was so much more true than that she was alive for about a month, that it was as if she had. My daughter is still traumatized, although not badly injured. Our dog is doing okay, but he doesn't like the sound of metal. And so I was really forced to consider, which moon am I dealing with here? I don't like this one. This is not the one I want, you know. But here it is, you know. And I have learned more about tracheotomies and rehab and ICUs. I'm really well informed about a whole world, a whole part of life that I knew nothing about, didn't want to know anything about. And then after about a year, Grace came home, and I learned even more. I've learned a tremendous amount. How do you take care of someone who needs your help every day? To be dressed, to be fed, to be entertained. This hardest one of all. You know? So this has been a revelation in my practice. Because, you know, when I compare my actual life to that little vase of flowers back at Tassajara, I think I really have been misunderstanding the Buddha's teaching for a very long time. I really thought that that was it. You know, it was my Horcrux. And I was counting on that to, you know, bring me through to eternity. It's like dear Voldemort. Same plan. But I don't think that now. I don't think that now. I actually have come into a sort of dumb devotion to real people and real service and daily life, you know. It's nourishing, actually. It's really nourishing. You know, the fruit in heaven doesn't ripen. We don't get to eat it. We don't get to eat our fantasies. We don't get to eat the love that never came. None of that. We really do get fed by irritable people doing irritable things together. You know, every morning I wake up and I think, oh, there's my zoo. You know, they're all looking at me, wanting to be fed. You know, one after the other. Start with the cats and the dog. And my daughter, then Grace. And me too. So, I changed my plans. I have no plans. That's my plan. No plans. I remember that something Mel Weitzman said to me. Do you all know Mel? Has he been here to talk? Anyway, you probably know. If you don't, he's a wonderful teacher over at Berkeley. And he was leading the practice period one year at Tassajara when I was down there as a young monk. And we have a Shosan ceremony, which is a ask the question in front of everybody else ceremony. So you go one after the other and you approach the teacher and you ask your question. And I said to Mel, dreams are sweet. I love to sleep. What do you have to offer? And he said, go wash your face. You know, this response was both, you know, exhilarating and horrifying. Because the exhilarating part was he touched me. He got inside my being, you know, like tag. And I really felt it. And the horrifying part was I knew I was not ready to have him be anything other than ashamed of me, because I wasn't about to give up my dreams of a special shamanic state to which I was personally called. You know, the chosen. I wasn't going to give it up. That wasn't enough. Go wash your face. I heard him. I knew what he meant. not yet. You know, it took many more years and a lot, near loss of someone I care for very much to wash my face. So I have a little poem to close. This is Kay Ryan, who lives in Mill Valley, or somewhere near. Lives near us, up there in the north. If she only had a minute, what would she put in it? She wouldn't put, she thinks. She would take. Suck it up like a deep lake. Bloat indiscriminate on her last instant. Feast on everything she had released, dismissed, or pushed away. She would make room and room as though her whole life of resistance had been for this one purpose. So on the last day, the last minute of the last day, she would drink and have it, ballooning like a gravid salmon or the moon. Thank you very much.
So fast.
Oh, dear. That's why you hide back there, huh?
Could you take some questions?
Of course. I'd be happy to. Does anyone have some questions?
Or comments?
Comments or corrections or improvements, anything.
I have lots of comments, but I'll withhold most of them. It's very good to see you.
Nice to see you.
Sometimes the Dharma talk is like a pinball game for me. I don't remember. I don't know if anybody remembers pinball games, mechanical video games, where you get a lot of bells ringing and stuff. And this is one of those for me. The word that's hitting me right now is the word responsibility, and the T-shirt that you had. And I recently had somebody sort of open that up for me, really kind of magically, because it was in an email exchange, and the person said, think of, you know, responsibility is nothing more than our ability to respond. Mm-hmm. And I went, whoa. Mm-hmm. It's not like, you know, I'd always thought of responsibility as carrying some sort of load. Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden I went, yeah. And it really, you know, it really changed that for me. And I'm not sure that it's changing my behavior, but it really kind of just opened up the concept. Yeah. Thank you.
So nice to see you.
To see you.
Did your daughter grow up at Green Gulch?
She did.
How was that raising a child in a monastery?
Well, for me, it was wonderful. She calls us the Crypt Masters. So don't you people ever do anything? I mean, it's kind of quiet at Green Gulch. She was the only kid for a while. So she's always dreamed of a two-story house and a car. So she got the car, finally. I don't know, she's wonderful, actually. I don't think she has an idea how much of an influence we've had on her against her will. You know, we kind of worked it all in. It's a little teenage package. But she's ready to go, you know, be out there. And still, she loves her home. She was away this summer and kept calling, I'm so homesick, I just want to be home. And I thought, well, this is good. I'll send you off again. It's been wonderful to have her as part of my training. I took her into, when she was little, she was 5 pounds at birth, we adopted her. And I took her into my teacher and laid her down and did 3 bows and left with her. Point. So it's been profound practice. I didn't value parenting until I did it. Now I do bows. I really think it's an amazing thing to take on. And not everyone manages it to their own benefit or to the benefit of their children. as we know.
Well, I just want to say thank you for talking. I didn't understand the two moons in the beginning, mm-hmm. but towards the middle and the end, I understood. Now I understand clearly. Mm-hmm. There's a lot to think about. Thank you.
Yes.
I'm sort of wondering if you would say that in this case that there's really only one moon, or are there not one and not two moons?
Yeah. Too bad we're not on another planet that has more than one to ask that question about, huh? Are there 12 moons? I think... And I'm going to say more than I should. I think if you notice your own experience of how many moons there are, you know, and start counting, I have to deal with my imagination, what I imagine to be so. I mean, I can't ignore that as a real factor. And I've tried standing out looking at the moon to get a hit on that. What is this? Moon? That's a funny thing to say when you're looking at the... So just to be in touch with the dynamic of your own mind and senses and perception and ideations and like, what are you thinking? You know, how many moons are there? What do you think? Do you have a... Have you drawn a conclusion yet?
I think it sort of vacillates.
Yeah, I think so too. It, whatever that it is. And again, that's what it is, a placeholder for an object. What's an object? You know, you keep shaving away at any of the things you say, and you'll find out that you're really not making any sense. And that's okay. That's actually pretty much what's happening, you know. But we also can't just not be responsible, to try to be responsible and to say things that make sense to help each other, you know. Don't fall in the hole, you know. That would be kind to make some suggestions when people are struggling or when they're sad. So I think we use words that are provisional. They're only for the purpose, in the better side of ourselves, of benefiting others. And our practice is about making that vow, that intention. So what's really so, you know, we could have fun talking about that. But what's the point? You know, why do you care? I think that's the more important. You know, the Dharma has these two pieces, or elements that are very powerful. One is the wisdom side, you know, how many moons are there? It is exciting, and it is fun, and we can challenge each other with those things. But that side, that is likened to the wings of a bird. That side is the wisdom side. Very smart. And this side is the compassion side. And they need to be equally strong. This one is actually at the service of compassion. As the Dalai Lama said, my religion is kindness. You know, we're really trying to do something to help people. And to use intelligence and wisdom and challenging questions as a benefit, you know, to bring people up. That sometimes we get confused about that. I'm not saying you did. Just not at all.
I remember, I think this was the last time you were here giving a talk, and I think the hospice might have still been here, mm-hmm. but you told this story about your daughter, and I believe she was like 5 or 6 at the time, and her goldfish had just died.
Ugh. Yeah, I do.
Yeah. You were trying to, I think you had to bury it with her, and I don't know if you actually explained to her.
It was the cat.
The cat?
The goldfish also died, but it was the cat that had died that I buried.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Okay. So, that was just a comment. So just
yeah.
It's okay.
Yeah, she was hiding under the bed. She was about, I think she was maybe 7 or 8.
Maybe, yeah.
And the cat died. And she was so, I don't want to come outside. She was, I was like, I didn't know what to do. I mean, I'm not a real mother. I don't know what to do. I'm guessing. I don't know what to do. So I put on my robes. And we wrapped the cat in white silk. And one of these, Tibetan. Mm-hmm. And the cat was, the tail was stiff, so I was sticking out of the silk. We were trying to get it. It was quite a real thing, And I dug the hole, and then we had flowers, and Grace and I, we got a basket with flowers, and we started walking around our yard in a circle, chanting with the cat, holding it, carrying the cat. And she came out. I said, "Do you want to throw flowers?" She said, "Yeah." So she threw flowers, and we went around, and then we laid it down, and she threw some dirt on it, and then she said, "What are we having for lunch?" So it's like a miracle. It's always a miracle. We don't know how to help. But sometimes it seems like that wasn't bad. That kind of worked.
You spoke about your flower vase moment at Tassajara. That got me to thinking, and I was thinking, I don't really think that I've ever had a moment like that in my life, and I was wondering if you could sort of elucidate that a little bit more.
Would you like one?
I don't know, but honestly, yeah. I don't think I have, or if I did, I didn't recognize it at the time. I just wanted to know if you could.
Yeah. Well, I think some people... I mean, you're obviously someone who says, I don't know which one it was. Maybe you're having them all the time. It's I didn't want to judge them as high quality or anything. It was just for me, I'm easily enchanted. I spent most of my childhood dreaming and reading books. So I have I'm inclined to hypnotic trance from birth. So it's nothing I did. It's just a tendency I have. And I spot others like me. We're all kind of bumping into things. So a dreamer. I'm a dreamer. And it was probably there was some reason I started preferring dreaming to being in my house with my family. So I think there's just maybe that relationship between what you fantasize and dream and imagine and what happens, like when a car hits you and you go like, whoa, where was I? That's the moment of awakening. You come out of the trance, come out of the dream. What were you thinking? Phew, I don't know. But all of a sudden, you're right there with it. So I felt like I was with the flowers. I was like, where'd they come from? What was I doing before I saw the flowers? Daydreaming, I'm sure. It's what I do best. So to come back from sleeping and dreaming and daydreaming and fantasizing to actually, the very Zen lessons and, wash the dishes, put them over here, put them away, take care of the flowers, take care of the plant, take care of the children, feed the cat. That actual engagement with what's in my hands and what's in front of my face as opposed to what's up here in my illusory imaginal world is for me is what the big shock was about. But that's my that's my connector. Maybe you have a few, huh? Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. What are you doing back there? Nothing.
Maybe.
Time's up?
Yeah.
I knew you're going to get the hook in. Yeah. I love him. I hope you all love him because he doesn't let me tell him that.
No.
When we're alone.
No.
Uh-huh. Got you nailed. So it's recorded. It's going to be podcasted.
Oh, great.
You are loved. He and I were tossing hard together. Please ask me later about the repairing the squeaking door.
No, no.
Ask me that. I'll tell you that story.
Can you tell it now?
It's when I fell in love. Do I have time? He cut me off. I do?
Okay.
All right, so. Were you the head of maintenance?
No, no.
What were you?
I was just in the shop, I think.
Yeah, okay, okay. So, Big Abbott. Big teacher.
Yeah, yeah.
You should not be named. The one who should not be named. Was bothered by the squeaking Zendo door during. Was this Sashin, wasn't it? Or something?
The end of the training period.
End of the training period. Okay. And every time he came in the back door, it would squeak. So he told the head of the shop to fix it, please. And so for some reason, I don't know what I was doing helping you. It was really odd, but anyway, he asked me to help him or something. So we had like 15 minutes to get the 3-in-1 oil.
Less, I think.
Less, maybe 10 minutes. The Hans going, and we got to get the bolt out of the door, squirt it with oil, and get the bolt back in the door. Kind of simple, but these are big, heavy wooden doors, beautifully Japanese handcrafted doors. And so we got the door off, we got the bolt out, we got the oil in. I think you handed me the bolt.
Yeah. That was a mistake.
That was a mistake. And it was greasy. And I dropped it. And I dropped it down in this little crack that was all the way down below the the deck of the Zendo where we couldn't get it. So, and then I started laughing because it was so but so did you, and we were laughing so hard and because we thought that we were going to be killed. But that's when I fell in love with the Reverend Mio. No, he said to me when I dropped it, because I was actually horrified, he said, "Why did you do that?" Anyway. So, well, thank you all very much. Please enjoy the rest of your day. Mm-hmm.